Support for WPR comes from Lawrence University in Appleton, home to 1,500 undergraduate students from nearly every state and more than 50 countries. Dedicated to an engaging global education. Lawrence.edu.
Support for WPR comes from Stafford Rosenbaum, a Wisconsin-based law firm celebrating 145 years of commitment to practical legal solutions in areas such as family law and estate planning. StaffordLaw.com.
You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's coming up on 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, July the 31st. And today is my birthday, a day when this song by Bob Dylan goes through my mind. Forever young. Forever young. And I want to know how to stay forever young. And so I have some help this hour with Dr. Zorba Pastor joining me to answer my questions and yours at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison 263-1890 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. We're going to talk about how we can live a longer, sweeter life with Dr. Zorba Pastor. Dr. Pastor, as many of you know, is the host of Wisconsin Public Radio's Zorba Pastor on Your Health, which you can hear Saturdays on the Ideas Network at 8 o'clock and 1 o'clock. He is also a clinical professor of family medicine at UW-Madison. He is a physician in a private practice or a family practice in Oregon, and he is author of The Longevity Code, Your Personal Prescription for a Longer, Sweeter Life. And Zorba joins me in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
Well, thanks a lot. In fact, I asked, Leo Duran, my producer, did ask, what do you want to do for your birthday? And I said, let's see, I want to talk to Dr. Zorba. And so thank you for, but you thought it was my 50th birthday.
Well, I thought, you know, what do I want to do for my birthday? This must be the big 5-0. I said, absolutely, I'll drop whatever I'm doing. I'm going to be there to celebrate her 50th. Then I kept on thinking, gosh, she looks so young for 50. She doesn't look like she's anywhere near 50, and you're not. You told me you're 39, right?
I did tell you that, but I'm a good liar, too. I am almost 50. It's 48. Today is my 48th birthday. And you start thinking about these, you know, things when you start approaching that 50-year mark. And I've been thinking about it for quite some time. I feel like I'm in my 30s still.
Well, frankly, you are. If you look back 100 years ago, roughly in the 1880s, 1890s, the average age of death was 49. So imagine that.
Oh my
God. The average age of death was 49. You look at the Revolutionary War, the average age of death was 45. You look at Sierra Leone today, and the average age of death is between 39 and 42. They have the lowest longevity in the world. So the reality is, at 48, within our culture, that was old. And frankly, back when I was a kid in the 50s and in the 60s, if you lived until 65 and you died, people said you had a good life. And nowadays, if somebody dies in their 60s, you go, what happened? Why did they die so young?
Yeah.
And that's because with a whole bunch of different things, from food and technology and good water and good food, we are living about 15 to 20 years longer than people did back a century ago. So you're right. 48 is like 30. That's exactly
well, I'm hearing now, because probably baby boomers are turning 60 now, that the 60 is the new 30.
Yeah, 60 is the new 30. Well, that would be nice. That would be nice. This year I turned 60, so I can't imagine that it's the 30. I would like to be 30. That'd be kind of
did
fun.
You turn
to be
60
like
this
that.
Year, Zorba?
Yeah, I'm going to going to turn 60.
Oh, you're
I'm
going not, to not th- see we're not there
no,
yet.
I'm not 59. I'm not having my 60th birthday yet. That's in August 19th. But my dad lived until the age of 87, and he was an active guy. He worked until he stopped, basically, until he had a stroke and died. And he sold fake antique gumball machines for dogs, and which was a sort of a strange thing that my uncle had developed. But he would always go in, and because he was an older guy, he would deal with people who are younger, and they would say, how old are you? And he would say, guess my age. And nobody would ever guess his age, because he was an active, vibrant person. person who embraced life. And frankly, that is the secret of a long, sweet life. It's not taking life in a passive role. It's taking an active action in your life.
Well, so when I went skydiving for my birthday last year,
wow.
I was taking an active role in my life.
Gosh.
I mean, or was that just a really stupid thing to do?
It depends on who you skydove with, whatever that.
Yeah,
whatever
it was a tandem. So
how
I
was
had,
it?
It was fun. I won't do it again. It was scary enough that I did it. I overcame that fear. I jumped out of that plane.
Now, are you afraid of? Are you afraid of heights? Normally?
Not terribly. No,
I'm terribly afraid of heights. Yeah. But I did. You know, when my 50th birthday, a bunch of people gave me a balloon ride, hot air balloon ride, and that was about.
That's on the list.
That's about all I could. I mean, that's what I could embrace. But the answer is yes, because when you overcome an obstacle, you gain what I call courage. And courage is an important part of being able to make decisions sometimes that are tough. If you've never made a tough decision, which is like, gee, I'm going to overcome my height fear and I'm going to jump out of an airplane and I'm going to try to have fun doing it. Then when you're faced with a tough decision such as, gee, I have a medical problem, how do I address that? You can then address that because you remember that you got over the fear of skydiving and you jumped out of the airplane and you lived to see it. And it's that ability, that courage to be able to do things that are kind of fun that allow you to have the courage to make a change when when you've got to make a change that's tough, frankly.
Yeah. Now, Zorba, you told me just before we started that you are working on a new book, and it has to do with our discussion today. So let's talk a little bit about that. The Four Pillars of Perfect Health is
right.
The working title.
The Four Pillars of Perfect Health. I believe that when you look at all the health decisions we have, and kind of when we look at our health, we have to look at what is our personal best health. Well, our personal best health is there are genes, what were we born with. There's our past history. So for instance, when you're 40 or 50 or 60, the chances are you're going to live a shorter time than somebody who's 10 or 20. So it's your past history and what you've done. And then 50% of your personal health is based on what you do today. You know, you're dealt cards. You've got cards in your hand. What am I doing now? And I think there are four things that underlie people who embrace health and make the right decisions. Mm-hmm. And frankly, people who don't. And we all know people who don't make any changes in their life, and we know people who are able to make changes. And I think it's knowledge, optimism, courage, and action. And knowledge is knowing something called health literacy, knowing what health is about, how to read a website, mm-hmm. how to make a decision on the health, how to find a health advocate, the right doctor, the right person. Optimism is removing the obstacles to optimism, which include depression and anxiety, but that only gets you to zero. How do you get to optimism where you say, hey, the world has something plus in front of me? You know, I've not gotten rid of my depression. I've gotten rid of the toxic relationships. How do I now develop that positive outlook? If you don't have a positive outlook, why make a change in your life? There's no reason to. Why buckle up? Why not drink when you drive? Why not smoke cigarettes? Why not do those things? And then courage is self-efficacy. It's empowerment. It's how do I make a decision that's tough? And frankly, jumping out of the airplane and making that tough decision, I'm ready to jump, once again, allows you to do that. And then action. A lot of people don't know how to make an action plan. Okay, how do I start a diet? How do I start an exercise program? How do I start chemotherapy? How do I begin to reduce my risk factors? So I think you need all four squares in order to reach a long, sweet life. And that underlies the information that we get in the world today.
We are talking with Dr. Zorba Pastor about how we can live a longer, sweeter life. Dr. Pastor is the host of Wisconsin Public Radio's Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I should say co-host because you've got some other
that's
guy
right.
hosting
yeah,
that with you.
Yeah,
you?
Tom, what's his name? It's funny when I go across the street, which I do quite often giving lectures, the first thing they say to me is, where's Tom?
Yeah, they used to say that to me all the time, too.
Where's Tom? He's not around. Yeah. Well, Tom isn't here. And the second thing they say, which they don't say to you, is, does he really hate tofu? Now, that's not something he says because that's kind of his shtick, but of course.
Or is he really as grumpy, a curmudgeon as he sounds? but, you know, I'm glad you're going to be taping Zorba so right after you get off the air.
Yes,
here.
Absolutely.
So we will.
He is not grumpy. He is a curmudgeon, but he is not grumpy.
We are happy to have Zorba with us this hour live to answer your questions too about how we can stay as healthy as we can and live life as full as we can, not only add years to our lives, but life to our years. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Good to have you along on this Tuesday, July the 31st. Coming up later this afternoon, Ben Marins is with you. And after 5 o'clock, why do people become addicted to drugs? After 5, Ben and his guest will discuss addiction treatment and recovery. That's At Issue with Ben Marins and his guest after 5 this afternoon. We're talking about our health with Dr. Zorba Pastor. Dr. Pastor, as you know, is with you every Saturday at 8 and 1 here on the Ideas Network with Zorba Pastor on Your Health. He is a clinical professor of family medicine at UW-Madison. He is a physician in a family practice. He is the author of The Longevity Code, Your Personal Prescription for a Longer, Sweeter Life. I have my own copy of your book, Zorba, which I think I got right when this has been out for a little while now,
yes,
right? Yeah,
yes,
this has
yes.
been out for a little while, and I did learn a lot of tips from this because it's not just how to live a long life; it's how to live a longer, sweeter life.
Right, and my research when I was doing research into longevity and looking at just kind of the issue, you know, you have 48-year-olds such as yourself. Mm-hmm. Who are healthy and basically are a healthy 48, and then you have people who are unhealthy 48. And when you first look at it, you say there are easy things that divide this up, people who smoke cigarettes and who drink too much and don't exercise and weight. But what I discovered, really, there are five spheres that influence you: physical, mental, family and social, spiritual, and material. And the physical sphere is, what am I doing with my physical body? The mental sphere are the obstacles to health, which really are depression and anxiety and not being a learner, not somebody who wants to embrace learning. And frankly, people who listen to public radio are learners. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. that's why they're here. They're, you know, they're, it's, yes, there's entertainment value, but yes, there's information value. And then there's the social situation. Friends and family really count. The recent article that showed that obesity goes with your friends and family is fascinating.
That is.
It fits with that perfectly.
Why is that? So if we hang out with people who are overweight, we might be overweight too because we just want to go
right.
out and eat?
Well, the article, the study was fascinating. Mm-hmm. Framingham mm-hmm. Heart Study, picture this starting in the 70s. Mm-hmm. Framingham, Massachusetts, a quarter or half the people were part of the study, huge study. And what they did was they asked, if we can't find you, because they were sampling them every 4 years, give us the name of your close friends, one or two or three close friends. Like, who should we call first? If they're not there, who do we call second? And who do we call third? So the researchers went back through, and they were often part of the study. So they went back and they looked essentially at who you named as a friend, you know, who was your buddy to name, and who are your relatives, because they just happen to list them. And then they looked at their weights. It was very, very simple. And what they did, and then they looked at their address. And what they discovered was, if your next door neighbor started getting obese, you didn't get obese at all. It had no effect. If your family started getting obese, that had some effect. If your buddy started gaining weight, that had the best effect, and it's if your buddy of the same sex. So in other words, here it is, two ladies would be more mm-hmm. likely to get heavy than if it was a lady who mentioned, you know, who was friends with a guy.
Yeah, that
and,
is.
And it was the same was true with health. If one started losing weight, it was more likely the other one started losing weight. And the study is mind-boggling because, you know, the buzzword is maybe obesity is catchy and maybe it's infectious, which is fascinating, but it's not. It shows that the social network is a great predictor. And then there are theories as to why this is. And one of the theories is that as everyone gets a little bit heavier, we begin to accept that as the norm. And that's one theory that's out there. In other words, you're a little bit heavier, I'm a little heavier, all our friends are a little bit heavier. Well, that's what it's like, and I think that really holds true.
Well, you just had a caller who gave up, and I was just going to go to him who wanted. He's in his 50s, and he's never had a sort of a diet and exercise routine and wanted, I guess, some help in just getting started.
Well,
and
the first step, you know, you're turning 50 and you go, what should I do? The first step are the list of health maintenance things you do at your doctor. That's kind of the first step. 50 is colonoscopy time. Great! I love it! I can't wait to get there. I've had my colonoscopy, and let me tell you, it's, well, you're asleep for it, so you don't remember
or
much.
Completely drugged up and don't remember a thing.
You don't remember a thing. Although I had a guy in my office yesterday, one of my favorite patients, and he said, one of the problems is I'm afraid when I'm put out, I'm going to start saying things that are inappropriate. And that is a common fear. But frankly, you get these medications, people don't say things that are inappropriate. So it's the colonoscopy time. It's the time to look at your cholesterol. Mm-hmm. Should be before that. But 50 is a great time to look at it. Check your blood pressure. Since we've adequately treated high blood pressure, we have dropped the stroke rate by 60 to 70%. That's in the last 3 decades. It's a huge amount. Heart attacks, for the most part, the treatment of heart disease is the treatment of blood pressure. You know, checking you for diabetes. All that doctor stuff. That's the first thing. Second step is, are you the right weight? If you're not, what are you going to do? Small steps. Bill Clinton really has shown as the paradigm for the idea that small steps make a big difference. 3 bites on a burger. Okay, so you can kind of picture that. At every meal, pretend you're eating a hamburger 3 times a day, you know. But 3 bites on a burger translate into roughly 10 pounds of weight a year worth of calories. That's all you have to do. 3 less bites at every meal and you will lose 10 pounds. That's not a lot. Mm-hmm. Now, it's not easy to do. Dieting is tough to do. It's really not an easy situation, but at least that maybe begins to look like it's manageable. Exercise, where do you start? Walk. Start walking. And the Framingham study has shown walk with a friend. It's shown do it with a friend. You're more likely to do it and keep it up. So that's one thing. The other thing is embracing those social relationships, looking towards a spiritual path. What do you think about at 50? You think about death. Well, that's okay. Think about death. What do you want to do with your life? Is it just making money? Is it just, you know, going from 9 to 5 to your job? Is it improving relationships in the family? Is it looking for a spiritual path or yoga? All these things count in. And I think 50 is just a great time to kind of re-inventory your life.
Good answers. Or what should we replace our sugar Cokes with Diet Coke?
Well,
that study that just came out
showed that really is not the best thing to do in your life. And I think the best thing to do is to look towards healthful drinks. So I'm a big fan of tap water. I'm not a big fan of bottled water because, as we know from Aquafina, a lot of bottled water is tap water. I don't think it's any better. But if you want carbonated water, that's great. You have carbonated water and you put a twist. You put some lemon or lime, or you buy it with lemon or lime. And then if you want to sweeten it up with some good fruit juice, some pomegranate juice, which is great, a little bit expensive, but it's delicious. Maybe a little bit cranberry juice cocktail. Don't drink cranberry juice cocktail straight up because it has more calories, but put it in some, as I said, some seltzer or maybe some Pellegrino water. That's just a way of, once again, looking at calories and read those labels. Perfect example, I have a book that I look at all the time called The King, Book of Calories. If you go to Culver's and get their chicken dinner, is 1,660 calories.
Seriously? That's my whole day.
That's it. The pot roast sandwich is 325 calories. You can have 5 pot roast sandwiches, and that's equal to the chicken dinner. And the chicken dinner is equal to 7 Snickers worth of calories.
What about the little tiny chocolate cake that I gave you to celebrate my birthday?
This is great.
I mean, which you didn't have. I mean,
I'm eating this cupcake.
It's okay to eat a chocolate cupcake, little mini one every once in a while.
It's okay to eat one every day. And in fact, the studies on dark chocolate have shown that 2 Hershey's Kisses a day worth of chocolate will reduce blood pressure by 2 to 3 points, and that can reduce stroke and heart disease. Absolutely. A little chocolate every day is perfect.
But you want to do the 2 pieces, not the bag.
Not the 2 bars.
Yeah, there we go. All right, to the phones again. Dennis in Wanakee. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning.
Morning.
Very good program. What about heredity? I can recall my grandparents and my parents with some pretty bad gnarly hands as they got into their, late 70s, 80s with arthritis. Is that something that we're just destined to, or I'm 60 now. I get up in the morning and, you know, the joints are a little stiff, and within a matter of a couple of minutes, they're fine. But is that a medicated thing, or what do you do about the possible onset of arthritis?
Well, there undoubtedly is a genetic component. Do you exercise at all? Do you do any exercise?
Yes, I do.
Okay, well, that's one excellent way to do that. Some people believe that glucosamine and chondroitin sulfate will help keep your joints healthy. Scientific evidence is kind of plus minus, but of all of the supplements that are around, that has the most scientific evidence behind it. And if you want to look at a good one, you go to Consumer Reports, get it out of your library, because they rated the glucosamine and chondroitin sulfate ones. You'll tell which one actually is there. The government does a lousy job of rating them. They don't rate them. They don't regulate them. Consumer Reports, to me, is the kind of magazine of choice for that. Exercise is good. If you have aches and pains, I'm a great believer of either using Tylenol or using ibuprofen or naproxen. I think they're great. But if you're using an anti-inflammatory drug, you don't want to use it at the same time that you're using aspirin, especially if it's ibuprofen. Ibuprofen specifically and aspirin seem to interact and reduce the effectiveness of a baby aspirin every day. So if you're going to take a baby aspirin and you're going to take ibuprofen, you want to separate them by at least 2 hours. So I tell people, you know, take your baby aspirin just at a different time of the day when you're taking your anti-inflammatory, and then you don't run into that. But getting back to arthritis, yes, you are destined to have those genes, but no, you may not have the gnarliness if you keep moving your hands, doing your joints well, keeping your weight off, and using anti-inflammatories and Tylenol as needed.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Thanks very much, Dennis, for the call. I know my husband has some arthritis in a knee. He's been a runner and had to have a little surgery on a torn meniscus. And I've been doing a little research into this. And I mean, people, especially his age, are having just their entire bodies replaced with different joints. It's called baby boomeritis.
Baby boomeritis. It certainly sounds like a disease. Well, what happened was years ago, go back 30, 40 years ago, before we had the scope and before we had artificial joints, when people had pain like that, they walked with canes.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
In fact, you associate the cane with the older person. When was the last time, you know, you go down the street, how often do you see people walking with canes?
You're right, you don't.
You know, it's much less. And the reason is joint replacement, hip replacement, knee replacement, and arthroscopy. Before they had the arthroscopy, the arthroscope to look into the knee, the joint, and fix it, people didn't have the surgery because it was a much bigger surgery. You had to open up the whole knee, the whole meniscus was often taken out. It was a big procedure. Now it's a procedure that still has pain and discomfort with it, but it's not nearly as big, as we say. So it's done much more commonly. And the reality is our joints, they do wear out. We don't know why. We know that arthritis is present in all animals, from insects such as bees and ants to dinosaurs. Dinosaur bones show arthritis.
Really?
Wow. Oh, yeah. Well, why do you think T-Rex was angry?
Yeah,
it was his
right.
hip and his joint. He wasn't young. He didn't just want to eat the other person. He had arthritis. He couldn't stand the pain.
I had a cholesterol test at the mall the other day. I had somebody there taking your blood. It might not be especially accurate,
but
I was
pretty accurate.
I was happy to see that it was. I had a struggle with keeping it below 200. I have a genetics that my family, history has a high cholesterol, and it was 179.
That's great.
So I can fight the genes through diet and exercise.
No doubt, undoubtedly. Now, the reality is diet does play a role. No doubt about it. It plays an independent role in heart disease and stroke. In other words, even if your cholesterol is perfect, if you have a lousy diet, you're still more likely to have a heart attack and stroke. But it plays a direct effect on cholesterol. For some people, diet is all they need. For other people, it really is. There really are medications, you know, the statin drugs, Lipitor, Zocor, and so on. And for other people, it's a combination of both. And so for you, you were able to take those genes, treat it with diet, and the reality is if you stick with that pretty much for the rest of your life, you will, you know, reduce heart attack and stroke. And frankly, that's still and will be the leading cause of death for the foreseeable future. It's not cancer. All the death rates, cancer and heart attack, they all double every decade. So when you're 50, you hear of people dying because there are twice as many at 50 who die at 40. And when you're 60, it doubles again. 70, it doubles again. And 80, it doubles again. And so that's why, you know, those things are more common.
I don't mean to bring up a very sad thing, but here I just went to the funeral of a friend over the weekend, 50 years old, 51 years old. Never smoked, was a healthy eater, athletic exerciser, lung cancer, the type of lung cancer that's not from smoking.
Same thing happened to my best friend in medical school, just in his early 50s. And always he jogged, he walked, he climbed, he exercised, and came down with cancer. And we don't know why. But I have a recommendation for what I think is the cancer preventing vitamin. The initial data that came out a month ago was mind boggling. And now we'll see whether or not it keeps up. Study out of Creighton University, Nebraska. Looked at Nebraskan women, and they were looking at the effects of vitamin D, specifically vitamin D3. That was on the bottle. Mm-hmm. And they were looking at hip fractures. They're just looking at it. So a third of the women had calcium and vitamin D. A third of the women had calcium alone. A third of the women, usual care. Measured vitamin D levels throughout the study, looked at osteoporosis, did densitometry examinations, looked at the fracture rate. Yeah, the women on vitamin D and calcium did a little bit better than the women on just calcium, who did somewhat better than the women on usual care. Not tremendously better, but better. So it showed that calcium and D works. But the women who had vitamin D and were taking it had a 47% drop in their overall cancer death rates over both the other groups of women, the calcium takers and the usual care. 47%. But more importantly, when you looked at year 2, 3, and 4, okay, year one, maybe we didn't pick up any cancer, but it was there. But you look at 2, 3, and 4, the drop was 79%.
Wow.
In the cancer rates.
That's amazing. And it's vitamin D3. That's different than
vitamin D. Well, it's vitamin D. But there are different forms of vitamin D. Uh-huh. And when you buy it, I'm now recommending 1,000 units. It's not as the issue with the feds right now is whether or not, they don't change a vitamin because of one study. But there are people looking back at other data from other studies to see whether or not this is true. It's a hard study to reproduce. It'll take years. But there are other longitudinal studies where they're looking at vitamin D consumption. Now, the funny thing about this is, vitamin D is the poor sister vitamin. If this were vitamin C, there would have been front page. Everyone would say, gee, take 2,000 units, 2,000 milligrams of vitamin C. It'll be great. If it were vitamin E, it would be a hoopla. It's
D
great.
Don't get no respect.
No, D don't get no respect. So, 1,000 international units along with a multivitamin and along with an aspirin every day when you're 50, I think that's great.
I've got it down. Thanks for that birthday present. We will go next to Nancy in Eau Claire. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, happy birthday, Joy.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. I wanted to add, I think you were talking about mental health also being part of a happy, healthy life. And something that I've been kind of thinking a lot about is, having a job that is very fulfilling and you enjoy going to work on a daily basis rather than the people who are working Monday through Friday for the weekend, and they're just plodding through their week going, oh, it's Wednesday, we're getting closer to the weekend, we're almost there. And you're losing, 80% of your year just thinking about getting to the weekend and plodding through your work life.
You are 100% correct. When I wrote the Longevity Code, How to Live a Long, Sweet Life, and I found there were 5 spheres, physical, mental, family and social, spiritual, and material. And you look at the material sphere, just exactly what you're talking about, and you find that job satisfaction is a key role. And there's a major study called the Whitehall Study out of England. 50,000 civil servants started in the 50s, continuing today, Whitehall 1 and Whitehall 2, 4 groups of civil servants. The top group, which were the sort of the administrators, the second group, the technical, the third group, the clerical, and the fourth group were the all other. And what they discovered was the higher up you were, regardless of your health habits, the longer you lived. In other words, if you were an overweight, diabetic, smoker, bureaucrat head, you live longer than a smoking diabetic, essentially person who was in maintenance. And then when they look back and they said, well, is it just money that follows? And it's true. The more money you make generally in our society, the longer you live. What you find is that money is a marker for education and that education and money are a marker for job satisfaction. The ability to change jobs. And the worst thing about a job, the worst job is a job where you have no control over your job. you know, somebody says, you do this, don't give me any guff, or you're out of here. And you know, we've all had jobs like that in our lives. And those are, like you say, people who mark time waiting for the weekend do not live a long, sweet life, and they should switch.
Well, I am very happy with my job because I get to request to talk to guests like Dr. Zorba Pastor, who is with us for the rest of this hour, to answer your questions about living a longer, sweeter life. 1-800-642-1234, the number to use if you'd like to call in and ask a question, or 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Hoping you'll stay tuned. Coming up, Veronica Rickert in for Kathleen Dunn, talking with her guests after 9 o'clock about revolutionizing the political process by engaging more citizens to discuss important issues. So we'll talk about that after 9 o'clock. We're talking with Dr. Zorba Pastor for the rest of this hour. He's a clinical professor of family medicine at UW-Madison. He is the host, co-host of Wisconsin Public Radio's Zorba Pastor on Your Health, heard Saturdays at 8 and 1 o'clock on the Ideas Network. Author of The Longevity Code, Your Personal Prescription for a Longer, Sweeter Life, and working on a new book, working title, Four Pillars of Perfect Health. And he's here to answer your health questions about living a longer, sweeter life. I am happy to have him here on my birthday to help me get on the right start the next 50 years. John in Wausau is our next caller. Hi, you're on the air.
Happy birthday, Joy.
Thank you.
And hi, Zorba. I think sometimes when we try to make changes from a health standpoint, we have to make it as simple as possible. I've been thinking about this for a long time, and I know that there's other states that have thought about this as well, that I hear the acronym 90210, and I immediately think of Beverly Hills, the TV program.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't we change this to say 50210, and we would have a healthier culture? At least five fruits and vegetables every day, zero sugared sodas every day, 2 or less hours of screen time every day, 1 or more hours of physical activity every day, and no tobacco use, and we would generally have a society that could reverse.
He needs to write a book on that. Huh?
You got a book there, baby. You certainly have a lecture there.
I think, Zorba, we need to have a social norms campaign with those five attributes, and then hopefully build in some creative way of building in responsible alcohol use in the whole picture, and we would change the whole face of society as I see it.
Yeah, I love it. I think that's a great idea. And you're right about keep it simple, stupid. You know, the kiss,
yes.
the kiss idea.
Yeah.
But I think that is a great idea. There was an article in the British Medical Journal 2 years ago, two years ago, on something called the poly pill, where there was a recommendation that you have a pill with a few components in it. You have aspirin in there. You have a drug to lower cholesterol. You have a drug for blood pressure. You have folic acid in there. It's a multivitamin. And then the particular researchers said, look, if we give small doses of all of this to the general population and we never measure for disease, in other words, we know these drugs in small amounts are useful for longevity, and we just gave this as sort of a tonic pill, if you would, he showed statistically how we would reduce heart attack and stroke globally dramatically with this thing called the poly pill. And that was his idea, was keep it simple, stupid. And your idea is great. I love it. 50210.
You know, I might only quibble that there's nothing wrong with 90210, because I think eating nine servings of fruits and vegetables is okay.
We can just keep it like that and say, what does 90210 mean? And we'll see that. And we'll see if I ever lecture in Beverly Hills, that's what I'll use.
The other thing I'd just like to say is that I think we need to start having kids in school become much more health literate based on their health education experience. Rather than inundating with content that they tend to forget, have them practice the key skills that they're going to use as a future consumer of the healthcare system. Mm-hmm. I think that's an important piece, too, that we're sadly neglecting.
Yeah, you do too, Zorba.
Oh, yeah. Health literacy is a big issue. There's an article that came out last week looking at something called health literacy among Medicare recipients. And if you decide you want to look at the article, you can Google health literacy, and the article will pop up, and it was reviewed in all the major newspapers. And so, in the article, looked at about 3,000 Medicare recipients, and they've been following these people. It's part of a longitudinal study for a number of years, and they measured something called health literacy. And there's a way to measure health literacy. It's a simple test that takes about 10 minutes. And they did an interview. And then what they've done over time is look at their health habits. And what they discovered was people, and a surprising number of people, were health illiterate. Roughly about 35% were health illiterate. 15% were marginally health literate, and the other half were health literate, okay? Mm-hmm. So you look at the 35% who were health illiterate, they had roughly double the death rate of people who are health literate. And you go, wow. And that's regardless of their health habits, regardless if they were a smoker, diabetic, high blood pressure, no matter what happened, if they were health literate, they were twice as likely to be alive 4 years later. And the answer is yes. It's a big issue. It's not taught in schools. It's not taught by adults, you know. You know, nobody, there's not a course at MATC in Madison. How do you gain health literacy? And when I read through what health literacy was, it was minimal stuff because nobody, you never learned it in school. That's
right,
the reason.
Right. Thanks very much, John, for the call. I'm going to remember 50210. And Hunter in Oconomowoc has been waiting. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Happy birthday.
Thanks a lot.
Hi, Zorba.
Hi.
I've got a question. Since I went through menopause recently, and I used to be pretty fit, and I didn't do anything different other than, you know, maybe become a little bit more sedentary, but the weight just came on. I mean, it was like every 2 pounds every week.
Yeah, I've heard that from many other women.
You bet. Yeah. First of all, as we get older, as humans, we get heavier. We lose 1% of our muscle mass every year, regardless. Doesn't make a difference, just by attrition. So not that when you look at somebody who's bulked up, they've taken their muscle cells and made them bigger. They've made them bulkier, each individual cell. But we lose roughly 1% of our muscle mass. So when we're 50, we have significantly less muscle than when we were 20. And, you know, you look at little kids that are really tiny, for instance, and how they can grab you. You know, they've got a lot of muscle mass for the size of their body. So essentially, we're doing less work because we have less muscle when we're older. And as a result, we're burning less calories. And frankly, we're eating the same amount. And where does estrogen fit in? You hear that all the time. Women say, I go through menopause and I put on the weight. And it's a multifactorial thing. It's not just the loss of estrogen. It's how estrogen affects your entire life. It's how much you eat and how much you exercise. And you have to spend more time looking at exercise when you're older, and it's more natural when you're younger. So, you know, my best advice is, you have to look at the calories that are going in there. You have hidden calories that you don't expect. If you take the average salad dressing, you eat a great salad, and you take the average salad dressing, use what the average American puts on their salad dressing, it's about 400 calories. So it's roughly almost two Snickers.
Yeah,
I look at a Snicker as a measurement of food.
Yes,
so is
good,
it a one Snicker or a two Snicker? So you may have a Snicker and three quarters on your salad worth of calories. And once again, small things. Bill Clinton showed 3 bites on the burger, that amount at every meal, and you will lose 10 pounds at the end of the year. Not easy to do, tough to do, but that's about the amount of weight, that's the way to visualize your calories.
Boy, that fat-free dressing, Zorba, though.
They're awful.
Oh, they're
awful. Oh, no, but I'll do what I did. My wife and I were in Paris a couple of years ago, and I saw what the Parisians do. What they do is they take delicious, fresh greens, you know, when you can get them, when now you can get them in Wisconsin, you know, fresh veggies. They put salt. I use sea salt on them, delicious sea salt that I buy, or I use salt that I can grind. Kosher salt is also, it tastes better. All salt is not the same, believe it or not, because it has a chunkier taste. And when it's chunkier, it tastes better on your tongue. I use fresh ground black pepper. And after I have salted and peppered my salad, at that point, I'll add the dressing. Now, you look at the dressings in the grocery store and pick them out. They're not the fat-free, the regular oil dressings. I hate fat-free. And you look at them, and they vary. So I can get Paul Newman, I think it's called triple cheese dressing, and that has half the calories of some of the other dressings. And then I use a small amount of dressing. Or I use really good extra virgin olive oil that I pay more money for and I use just in my salad. And then my wife loves vinegar, so she'll take that and put a lot of balsamic vinegar on it. And you can cut your oil. mm-hmm. by one half or three quarters and have a delicious salad.
Sounds good.
That's the way to do it.
Is the sea salt just a matter of taste, or are there better nutrient properties?
They claim they have more nutrients, which is true, but they're microscopic nutrients. Mm-hmm. It's that, to me, on a salad, it just tastes better because what happens is the crystal is larger, and when it goes onto your tongue, it gives your tongue a sense of salt that is brighter. And that is different. You tend to use less salt when you do that. Same with cooking, by the way. If you salt your food, if you don't salt when you're cooking, you reduce your salt by 50%. After you cook.
Yeah. Well, another one for my list. And I forgot to mention that Zorba is also the author of Zorba Pastor's
Heart
Healthy Recipes from Your Kitchen.
Guilt-free and tasty recipes from the kitchen. That's right.
Of Zorba Pastor. It's a mouthful, but there's some good recipes in there, too. John in Madison is with us now. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, about a year ago, I read a summary of a really massive study. It was a woman's health study. It was like 8,000 nurses followed over about 11 years. And they had this conclusion, which really struck me as incredible, and that was that caffeine and coffee didn't predispose the women in the study to developing hypertension. But if the caffeine was in as few as between 2 and 3 16-ounce servings of soft drink a day, these women developed hypertension 30 to 40% greater than what would have been expected. To me, this is something that should have been, one, verified, but two, the public should have been alerted to it in view of our habits of drinking soft drinks. I wonder what you think about that.
Well, first of all, soft drinks are the big bugaboo that we have. I was looking at, I think it was an article in the New York Times that looked at the consumption of soft drinks, compared it to bottled water, seltzer water, and so on. And I was just kind of shocked at the amount we consume. I don't know, it's something insane, like 60 gallons per person every year or every 6 months or something. I don't drink much in the way of soft drinks, but all you have to do is look at the trucks going around your city and you'll see how much we consume. There's nothing healthy about a soft drink. We all know, as a society, soft drinks are junk food. We know that. The issue with diet soda is that people believe that diet soda will keep their weight off, and the answer is no. There is no study that shows that. So, in other words, although we consume large amounts of diet soda, we get our calories somewhere else.
That's right. Because I was going to say, it makes sense that if I have a diet soda rather than a milkshake at the...
You would think so, wouldn't you?
But I'll get those calories somewhere else.
What happens is you have your diet soda with your milkshake. And that's what it comes down to. But diet soda, it's roughly 1 teaspoon per ounce. So when you're having a 20-ounce Coke, or for instance, as a good example, you're having roughly 20 teaspoons of sugar equivalent, and the other thing it has to do with high fructose corn syrup. Is it addictive, and is that the issue? Because it seems to be in everything, and there's some people who believe that it's addictive, that it's not just an empty calorie, but it spurs us to eat more empty calories and to sort of we like sugary things. Sugar has been popular ever since basically we were able to refine it, but the reality is we go over the top. So you're right, soda should be out of the diet. We know it. A lot of people have substituted bottled water. And the fact is, I think what you should do is use tap water out of your sink, unless you're in a strange environment or you're on a well where the tap water doesn't taste good. Put it in nice bottles you like. Put it in your refrigerator and take it with you every day. Spend your money. Why do the green, why do the carbon footprint for making another plastic bottle?
But if I want that caffeine buzz from my morning coffee, that's okay.
Absolutely.
That's okay for me.
You know, we're such a puritanical society, that we want to believe that all alcohol is bad for us and all caffeine is bad for us. And the reality is a drink a day is good for us. Now, if you're an alcoholic, you've got a disease. Mm-hmm. It's bad for you. But studies have shown that people, not alcoholics, they're out of the study, people who never drink at all actually have a higher heart attack rate and stroke rate than people who average one drink a day. And nobody knows if it's the effect on platelets or if it's the relaxation effect or it's the personality or it's what they do. Nobody knows that. But once again, a drink a day is fine. A cup of coffee or two cups of coffee a day are fine. It's moderation.
Thanks, John. Sarah in Kakana is with us. Hi, Sarah.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My husband and I are going to be having our first child in January.
Congratulations.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And I've been listening to a lot of callers calling about changing their life after 50 or later on. And my husband and I have been talking a lot about the natural food aspect. And I was wondering if you'd speak to that effect. And anything that you can see as like a preventative measure starting right away?
Well, when we look at organic food, I mean, which is sort of what I take from that. You know, it's an issue. As society, we've decided that there are issues, for some of us, big issues when it comes to insecticides and what are used on our crops to grow. And the other side is, you know, where does organic fit in? Organic is more costly. Why? Because often they're smaller farmers. They're spending more time with the plants. There's more work input. And it's become more popular. And if you look at organic food, which is now becoming available mainstream in supermarkets, the price is beginning to go down. If you go to Whole Foods, which really is whole paycheck because it's so expensive, you know, you say, well, how can I afford this organic food? And for many, many years, I'm not against the organic movement. I've never really embraced it. And then this Chinese thing came out. And all of a sudden, I realized, I don't know what I'm eating. I don't know where it's coming from, you know, including supplements. You know, they were basically using antifreeze because it tasted sweet, and it was cheaper in the food stuff. And I thought, I totally agree with the Congress, which now says we have to label all food and where it comes from. Right. And I was drinking my cranberry juice cocktail. You know, it's not straight cranberry juice. You can't drink it. It's bitter. And I read the label on the cocktail. I never read it before. And it says naturally sweetened, no sugar added. So I thought, well, sweet. What is this? Well, it's grape juice. It's grape juice that they added to it. And then I read the bottom of the label. Grape juice may come from the United States, Canada, Australia, or China.
Goodness.
Then I went and I looked on the FDA website. When it's an ingredient point of view, the number one ingredient listed means it's the most.
And it was antifreeze.
Used. Well, antifreeze should have been in there, maybe. But when it comes to country of origin, it doesn't fit it at all. So they put Canada first, Australia second. I can't remember, again, what was third. I just said it. But China was the last one. And in fact, China may have totally provided this. Well, I don't know what's in it now. So, you know, organic means you're going to know what's going on, and it has a better food chain safety. And until the FDA gets a handle on this, it certainly is a consideration.
We're going to try to get a couple more in, real quick ones. Sarah in Appleton, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, it's Sharon.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. Happy birthday, Joy.
Thank you.
I have a quick question. I'm a label reader, and when it talks about fiber on the label, it always separates insoluble versus soluble. And I wondered, which is better for you? Which do you need more of, and how much of them do you need?
Well, they both of them are useful. I can't quote you the numbers because I don't have them in front of me. The more fiber you have, the better off you are. A soluble fiber is more likely to reduce heart attack and stroke. That's why it's listed. And insoluble fiber is better for your bowels, less diverticulosis, which means fewer pockets in the colon, better bowel movement every day, or however often you have one, which especially is a problem for older folks. And that's kind of why they're listed separately. The feds had this separated out, I think, about 10 years ago. And once again, I don't know the amounts, but if you Google soluble fiber daily requirement, that will pop up and you'll get a government website. Or you go to FDA.gov, and it'll be on there. And once again, put down insoluble fiber, it will pop up.
Thanks a lot for the call. We're out of time, Zora, but this is what I'm going to do to celebrate my birthday. I'm going to go to a yoga class with a bunch of my girlfriends, and we're going to have one alcoholic drink and two pieces of dark chocolate. How does that sound?
It sounds perfect. And you started your day with a good dark coffee.
I did. That's right. I got my buzz there. We really appreciate. Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure to be here, Joy.
Dr. Zorba Pastor, he's going to run off and go tape his Zorba Pastor on Your Health program that you can hear Saturdays at 8 o'clock and 1 o'clock. We thank him very much for his time on this, my birthday. And thank you for all your calls and kind words. Thanks to Leo Duran for producing the hour. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network.